Hello and welcome to the show today. This is your host, Dr. Karen Wyatt. I'm excited to welcome my guest, Michelle LeBrun, here to join us today. I'll tell you a little bit more about her. Michelle LeBrun is an award-winning documentary filmmaker, producer, director, and educator. Michelle's company, Harkin Productions, works with organizations to help them achieve their mission by producing short documentary-style videos to help with marketing, fundraising, operational, and training efforts. The national award-winning documentary, Death, A Love Story, about the end-of-life journey she traveled with her husband, Mel, marked Michelle's debut as a filmmaker, having directed, produced, written, and photographed the film. It was nominated for the Grand Jury Prize at the 1999 Sundance Film Festival, won top awards at several other film festivals, and aired on national PBS and CBC Canada. Death, A Love Story is currently used in classrooms in over 400 universities and colleges in the U.S. and Canada, and is available in the educational market at deathalovestoryvideo.com. Michelle, I'm so happy that you're taking the time out to be here with me today. Thank you, and welcome to the show.
Thank you, Karen. It's great to be with you.
Well, ever since I saw your movie, Death, A Love Story, and I know that you made that movie probably 15 years ago or so, I really wanted to ask you, what motivated you to make that movie?
Let's see. Well, first of all, thank you. I mean, thank you for, your kind words about the film. And, you know, indeed, it has been throughout these years just a great gift to hear from people, both through emails and letters, through professors using the film here and in Canada, just the very, it's been a great gift to hear how it's touched people and how it's being used. I just feel incredibly honored to have been able to do it, in all honesty. So the motivation was numerous. Mel, my late husband, who the film is about, had been a director and producer in Hollywood and an educator himself, actually. He had co-founded AFI, NYU, and film schools, and then was chairman of the Hughes Film School when I met him. And, you know, we had always just sort of shot video together. We were in theater, he was in film, and we were just always shooting video. And so when he was diagnosed, with a fever pitch, we started just sort of videotaping everything that happened. Mel went and experienced lots of different kinds of alternative therapies, got lots of second, third, fourth opinions about his primary liver cancer. And we just constantly had the video running, and the thought was that we would basically look back at it and sort of remember what exactly occurred in the kind of breakneck pace of trying to, get treatments after one has been diagnosed with something like this. I'm sure a lot of people understand that. And so what happened was, because he was a filmmaker and had lots of, very well-known filmmaker friends around him, because of the nature of the way that Mel was really able to share his passing with myself and others in the room, folks just said to me, you should really think about making a film with all of this material. So there was that as motivation. And then there was also the fact that I just, increasingly started to just kind of feel in my bones that there must have been, there's other people out there who have had the kind of experience that I had sitting with Mel as he passed. And I want to make this film to kind of touch them, contact them, be in community with them. Mm-hmm. There's so much, still there is today, although it's certainly changing as time goes by. But, still even today, there's lots of fear and loathing. And how do we talk about this? How do we deal with, how do we just be present with death? And so I wanted to also make the film to as an embodiment of that. And again, I just had the feeling that there must be so many other people out there who had either experienced this or, you know, would want to see my experience as a help for them, which indeed it has been. I mean, I can't even tell you how many people over the years have said, this film just helped me sit with my son as he was passing. This film has helped me, you know, be present and more at peace with my own imminent death due to ovarian cancer. I mean, you know, for people to say these kinds of things to me out of watching my film is just, you know, it's like I'm speechless in the face of it. It's a great gift.
Well, I'm so impressed with the courage that both you and Mel had. I guess Mel in the first place to allow this process to be videotaped of him, and just the honesty that you both portrayed during extremely difficult times and times of great confusion and uncertainty, and to portray all of that with this, with it's really, I guess I could almost say brutal honesty, but such important honesty, as you mentioned, at a time when our whole society still wants to deny and cover up these realities about the processes that we go through at the end of life, that your film just stands out for that reason, for the honesty that it conveys. And I can imagine, I know I had the experience of being a caregiver for my mom this year as she passed away. And the overwhelming feeling I had was of really being alone so many moments as I sat with her. And so I can imagine the great comfort that many other people out there have taken in being able to see a film and understand this human process that we all go through and that we really all eventually share it together.
Right.
We all share these passages and this emotion and the pain.
Right, and eventually we are all we play any number of these roles, the caregiver, the family member, the loved one, you know, and the patient, the one that actually then dies. So to avoid that conversation and to not want to look at that and be front and center with it sort of robs us of, I think, a lot of potential poignant beauty in relationship and in life.
And that term poignant beauty, that so depicts this movie. And
thank you.
It takes you as a viewer through the full gamut of emotions because there's humor in it. There's humor.
Yeah.
There's great love. There's pleasure and enjoyment, and there's the utter devastating disappointment at the same time, and pain and loss, and it's very inspiring. In that regard, I can see that the movie itself is a tremendous tribute that you've made to Mel and to his life, and it's this lasting legacy that's out there for the rest of the world. And I loved it near the end of the movie when Mel said he finally understood the difference between healing and curing, which you could quote more about that. I'm not sure I would say it right, but that alone, this movie is about healing.
I don't remember the exact words off the top of my head, but basically, you know, he thought that it was about curing his body. He thought that what the journey here was about curing the wounds and the various places. I mean, if you see for the audience out there seeing the film, you see all the various alternative approaches he seeks out. He really seeks out all kinds of different things. But at the end of the day, he then comes to realize that it was really about healing. It was really about sort of, you know, on some level, I think just profound gratitude. You know, at the end there, he just had profound gratitude for his and my relationship, for his relationships with all of the other you know, amazing artist, as he puts it, in his life. You know, just all the rich experiences that he had had. And that was the healing. You know, the healing was just, I think, at the end of the day, because he was always, both of us were always like major seekers. You know, we're always sort of seeking out other modes of understanding the world in which we're living in, both politically and spiritually. And so, yeah, I think at the end of the day, there was a kind of profound letting go, appreciation, gratitude, and in that way, healing. He had also been someone who had come from a very tough kind of background, in that both of his parents had been in concentration camps, and, you know, he himself would indeed have those kinds of, you know, second-generation nightmares and such at times. And so I think there was, and pogroms, I mean, he was very, all of that was very alive in him as well, his Jewish heritage. And I think for him there was also a profound healing around all of that as well.
Well, it's as if he brought healing to the generations, even to generations before him, as if he was carrying the pain of his parents and their entire generation, and that he, within his own lifetime and his end-of-life experience, was able to bring healing almost retroactively back in the past for all of that history that he carried. And that was one of the things that was so beautiful and profound. At the end of the movie, you used the imagery of flames and talked about how all of this old history was kind of burning away. And I love that. I love that analogy, because I think the spiritual growth process is a lot about that. It's burning away what doesn't serve us anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. And that absolutely was the intention behind the flames. And which, interestingly enough, quick sidebar, that was, I don't know if I told you this before or not, but that was actually shot right after Mel died. I actually went to Bali, because I'd always heard it was a culture that was very spiritually connected, and also a culture that was very expressive of that spirituality through the arts. You know, and indeed I found all of that. But I happened upon a cremation ritual that was occurring for a man who had died, who had a monarch-type system, was going to be a patriarchal type system was going to be the next king, but they had moved to presidents and stuff like that. So there was a 3-week cremation ritual, and I shot like every single portion of that leading up to the final cremation. And those flames are actually from that cremation.
But the flames were just this beautiful purification like tempering steel to make it, you know, more refined.
Right. Exactly how they were intended.
Yeah. Even in my own spiritual growth, I can think of, you know, sometimes that process of letting go of and leaving behind the parts of us that don't serve us anymore, it's difficult. It's a difficult process to go through. And so it is almost a fire and a flame that we have to walk through for that to happen.
Or just sit with. I mean, in my spiritual tradition of Shambhala meditation, you know, or just meditation in general, there is a kind of sense of just sitting in the fires of, you know, who we are, and letting it all burn away, you know, letting it all come to the surface, come to consciousness, to be seen, to be present with, and disappear, you know, burning it away in the simple act of sitting in meditation.
And that brings up a question I had, Michelle. Were you practicing Shambhala meditation during this time of Mel's illness and his dying? Is that something since then?
Well, I mean, I've been meditating off and on since I was like 16, but I wasn't actually doing a sort of formal practice the way I am now at that point in time. You know, Mel and I both meditated, but we weren't actually as consistent with it. Now, once I started to edit the film, I got very consistent with the meditation and was meditating every morning as a way to really just get out of the way of the process and let it just happen, the editing process of putting this film together. I mean, there are ways in which I kind of feel like Mel and I made the film together, in all honesty. But it's only really in the last, like, 3.5-4 years that I actually have a more consistent Shambhalian practice that I do every day. That's really more now than it was then.
And I'm curious about your process, because we talked about the healing Mel experience at the end of his life. Would you say, as a caregiver, being there with him and sitting with him through that process, was there any healing that took place for you personally in your own life?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, as I say in the narration of the film at the end there, a few things. Through my own willingness to simply be present and listen to him as he passed, indeed a kind of burning away for me as well. You know, my hopes that he might live, burning away. My hopes for the future, burning away. All kinds of reference points, really, just burning away. And somehow, you know, sort of brokenheartedly set free in that way. It's kind of a difficult process to describe, but that's really what it was. And, you know, it's that sort of tenderheartedness, brokenheartedness that I really try and sort of carry through my life. And it's, you know, easier in certain times and harder in other times. Life is so fast-paced and there's so many different things to deal with, but that kind of awareness also, I think, for me, there was a profound awareness sitting with Mel at the end that this is not it. That which we can touch, taste, feel, smell, and hear in this particular life stream really isn't all there is. There really is more than that. And it was like, I know that now the way I know, sort of knocking on wood, if you will, or something. It's very real for me. And in that way, sort of opened me to the knowledge and the awareness that there's something very profound going on here on a constant basis, you know, alongside the sort of quotidian affairs that we have to attend to. And trying to really, and that's what I do now through the meditation, is continually returning to that place and that awareness and that reality and living my life from there as much as possible. So.
Well, one of the constants throughout this movie, and given that it's a movie that has so many ups and downs within it as we go through the process, but the constant throughout this movie is the great love that you and Mel have for one another. And I'll say it in the present tense, assuming, because it is that great love that actually resulted in the brokenheartedness in a way. And that's one of the things that I write about in my book, What Really Matters, that love really does break us open. When we love that deeply, we make ourselves vulnerable to another, and we have the courage to be there, to be present and be there no matter what happens, and to go through all of the pain and the suffering together. That is what breaks us open, but then that in turn is what allows us to have amazing compassion and to even have an impact on the rest of the world, because we've been broken by it.
Absolutely. And I think there's something also in that sort of brokenheartedness and that compassion. You know, what I find at any rate in my teaching is there's something about that, I think, that it's also then, you can also then hold the space for others to be the best possible whoever that they can be. Do you know what I mean? The most creative mm-hmm. kind of shine, basically. I think there's a way, and when you're living from that place, you can also completely allow the space for others to live from whatever that means for them at the same time. I mean, I feel like I noticed that with my youth media kids, you know, who come from these really intense backgrounds. I feel like I really noticed that with my college kids, you know, who often are in classes where professors are trying to power trip them and stuff. You know, if instead you can really be living in that brokenhearted, open-heartedness, you can actually allow others to be the best person that they possibly can be at the same time, because you're all in it together. Mm-hmm. You know, there's that great old quote from the Merry Pranksters, I think it was, if I'm not mistaken. We're all bozos on this bus. Do you know what I mean? It's like we're all just trying to work it out one way or another, you know?
Exactly.
So,
and once you have been broken open by love, it's almost as if you have faced the greatest fear already, and you no longer have to be afraid. You no longer have to try to control everything to prevent your fears from becoming realities. You've already faced that.
So
you can let go so much more and just surrender and let it be, and then truly be present and be authentic in the moment for whatever is happening for people. So I can see how making this movie has had a profound effect on all the work that has come since then, and just on your life in general and your career and the work that you're continuing to do out in the community.
Yep, absolutely.
Was there anything, I guess one of the questions I had written down is just, was there anything that surprised you during this experience that you found yourself really unprepared for or very surprised by during the process of Mel's illness or even the process of creating the movie?
I think there was just a variety of surprises all along the way. But certainly one of the main ones was just the, you know, what does it mean to go on this ride, which, as you said up top, is one of just constant uncertainty. It's like just constant uncertainty, you know, is which doctor is correct in all the various doctors that one is talking to. As you'll recall, there's the doctor that we talked to on the phone in Switzerland who has a whole way that he treats cancer, which has nothing to do with transplant. You know, there's, of course, the doctors in Los Angeles at the time that we were dealing with. So the constant uncertainty about different people's opinions, how things are going to go, you know, the doctor in Switzerland gave us a sense that perhaps we didn't have to do chemoembolization before his transplant, and we then went forward to the doctors with the request, because Mel was actually very healthy and strong going into the transplant because he had been doing so much alternative stuff, that he did not want to do the chemo before transplant. But of course, that's a no-go. They, you know, the doctors have their protocols, and you just either do them or there's the door, kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a surprise. You, how much control do you have under your own, rather for your own care? Another thing that was a surprise, certainly along the way, was sort of how we were treated. I mean, on one level, Mel was pretty well known, so there was a lot of respect, certainly. I mean, not we were treated disrespectfully, but certainly not treated as part of a team. You know, we weren't actually treated as part of the deciding team. It was more like, this is what's happening, here's what we're going to do. We did tons and tons of research and asked tons and tons of questions on a constant basis, really wanted to be informed consumers, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
But all of our questions, which you can also see in the film, were sort of met with, you know, humor and disdain. And then, of course, what was surprising at the end of the day is because of all of the questions and research and everything we had done, trying to be parts of the team, to then be confronted with what he ultimately got, which is graft versus host, was a real shock. In other words, why hadn't that ever come up? Mel, throughout the entire film, is constantly trying to weigh whether he really wants to even do the transplant or not. He was much older than me, and like 62 at the time, and was always weighing, does it really make sense to give a liver to someone my age? Does it really make sense to, you know, what is the quality of my life going to be when I'm taking 40 medications a day? And we used to travel a lot. Constant sort of questioning, both medical and sort of psycho-spiritual. And yet at the end of the day, this whole graft versus host thing, like, never even came up. So there's tons of things that were sort of, you know, a whirlwind of shocks and surprises all along the way, I would say. Mm-hmm. You know, and then needless to say, the biggest surprise at the end of the day was the way in which Mel was actually able to share what was occurring to him as he was actually passing.
One way in which this movie profoundly touched me as a doctor, because mm-hmm. I got to see my own profession through the eyes of a patient, and it was very shocking to me. And I had a sense, I mean, I've known lots and lots of doctors. I've known some with great bedside manner, some with mm-hmm. terrible, terrible relationships with their patients. But it was so shocking to me to see the video recording of these interactions as they actually took place with doctors. And I just felt terrible despair. I was in pain as I was watching it, like, oh, my goodness, how could this be? And mm-hmm. that was very eye-opening for me and really helped me understand the dilemma that patients and their loved ones are going through when, as you said, you get different advice from different people. No mm-hmm. one is there to help you put all of that together or to give you a bigger framework for how do you look at that and understand mm-hmm. where it's coming from. And you're really left on your own. And not only that, but then when there, as you said, there are medical professionals treating your questions with disdain or even mm-hmm. laughter or brushing them off and not answering them.
Mm-hmm.
I see this movie as a tool that needs to be used in medical education settings to help doctors, mm-hmm. just to help us look at ourselves and how we come across to patients mm-hmm. and their families.
Yeah, and it is being used that way a lot at this juncture in time. You know, lots of, indeed, as I can't remember if I'm repeating myself, but yeah, over 400 actually colleges and universities in the U.S. and Canada are using it now. And actually, I'm co-facilitating some workshops with Dr. Mitchell Levy, who teaches at the Brown Alpert Medical School here in Providence and is also director of the ICU at Rhode Island Hospital. So he and I are actually co-facilitating death and dying conversation, you know, dignity and death workshops for, indeed, physicians and nurses and end-of-life care professionals around the country. We've done a few. And that specifically is my role, in part, in these workshops as we show the film. And I am then the patient, the caregiver. Mm-hmm. And here's the story of what it's like from the caregivers and patients' point of view in these end-of-life care conversations, or how it can be at any rate. So tell me what some of the realizations for you were. What were some of the things that were shocking to you as a doctor?
Well, I was a little bit surprised at how much the advice you were given varied. I mean, I am alarmed because it felt to me that each person that you talk to, each specialist that you talk to, kind of had their own agenda or their own area and what they believed was right. And even if they gave lip service to the idea that you get to make choices here, mm-hmm. it was clear
yeah.
that they had their
yeah.
own bias. This is the right thing to do. And that disturbed me, because if there's one thing that became clear to me in all my medical training, it was that there are not really very clear right answers. That's the thing that I took away from my training, is that I cannot tell people what to do. I need to help them sift through all the possibilities and treat every patient as an individual and sift through those possibilities. And I think I wasn't aware how much that might be lacking, especially among certain specialists who, or even subspecialists who, they just view their own area quite narrowly and may not be looking at the bigger picture or considering the whole greater good for the patient and family that's involved.
Well, that's so extremely well put. And, yes, that's, you know, I mean, that sounds really harsh, but at times they kind of felt, even though they were these, you know, sort of nationally known specialists in their field, they kind of felt like, you know, car mechanics a little bit to me. It's kind of like, this is the thing, this goes here, this is that, and that's what we're doing. Boom, done. You know, and so it was very, very tough in a lot of ways. I mean, you know, there was like this, we had learned about certain kinds of alternative therapies, one of which was actually using, I guess, urea creatinine or something, which I guess is also just a basic test that is done regarding liver function, if I'm not mistaken. And but we had heard about it as a therapy, and so we brought it up to them as, you know, is this something that might also, if Mel was doing it in tandem with everything else, help support the liver? And, you know, they just sort of laughed it off as ridiculous and like that.
A total rejection of anything alternative that was outside their experience level, but also outside their scientific mindedness in a way.
Yeah, and that's, you know, I mean, it's sort of bizarre to say, but that's exactly how it felt. It felt like on some level they didn't actually understand, like, the biochemistry of what's going on or something, it almost felt like. You know, I mean, that's why I say, it, you know, it, like car mechanics, it was sort of, I don't know, it, you know, I don't want to be too negative about it, but, yeah, it was very off-putting and just kept basically throwing us back on ourselves and each other to muddle our way through. And as I said earlier, not really being treated as a partner in the process, not really taking a lot of our questioning seriously, you know, and at the end of the day, he winds up with something that, you know, never even had come up as a possibility in our conversations. You know, there's another scene in the film where just before he gets his hemoembolization, he's literally lying on the gurney, has already had some modicum of medication administered, I think, to basically just sort of calm him down, perhaps ultimately put him to sleep or something prior to the process. So he's groggy, and they have him, like, signing informed consent forms, like a bunch of them. So he's, like, lying on the gurney, and, you know, one of the nurses is kind of, I don't know if you remember that scene, but one of the nurses is, like, holding the papers up in the air. And you know, you hear in my voiceover, informed consent, there's, like, no time to even read these papers, you know.
And he's so groggy, he wouldn't understand what they're trying to explain anyway.
Some things just, you know, a lot of things actually just sort of made no sense. You know, just kind of made no sense. I mean, the whole kind of environment, really, of the ICU, it's completely antithetical to families being with their loved ones. You know, there's, like, visiting hours. But I sort of took the bull by the horns, as it were, and, you know, particularly when it was clear that he was dying, I just sort of demanded that the television never go on in the ICU room. I sort of, you know, demanded that I have music that I know he loves going in the ICU room. And I really just attempted to sort of make that environment one that would be just really comfortable and loving for him. Now, another thing that's kind of interesting about all of this, which does come up in our workshops, which is not in the film, is that, and it's kind of, you know, a lot of what our workshops are about are actually looking at these medical professionals, talking with these medical professionals and really drilling down to why it's so hard to actually say to a family member your loved one is going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say in that context that when we were in the ICU at UCLA Medical Center, you know, there were, it was just, you know, it went on and on about all the various different kinds of, you know, matchings they were trying to do to kind of reinforce the liver. I mean, basically graft versus host is when the white blood cells become virulent and take over the bone marrow, I guess, the whole system of the host body, the person's body. So an ICU nurse at one point came up to me and said, Michelle, can you come with me? I went with her, and we literally sat in a tiny, tiny little linen closet. And she said to me, I know you haven't been through this before, but, you know, I see it all the time. You need to know that your husband is dying. And you need to now do whatever you want to do to make it comfortable for him to die. And I so appreciated that because none of the doctors would tell me. They were just endlessly, you know, cure at all costs, running around trying to get this thing and that thing, and now we're going to try this and now we're going to try that. And because, you know, doctors just cannot find a way to actually tell the family members that the loved one is going to die, people miss all manner of opportunities to indeed have this incredible time with their loved one as they die, and to prepare the room and to prepare, you know, everything. So this ICU nurse had to take me into the linen closet and sit me down to tell me that.
Wow, it's so interesting, as if she had to hide almost. She had to hide away so that no one would hear her do it because, that's really shocking.
So it really underscores, I think, the fact that it's extremely important that somehow medical professionals begin to really find a way to, if you will, make the ICU a sacred environment, you know, bring mindfulness training into everywhere, you know, into all the medical universities, into actually hospitals. I mean, working with Dr. Levy, I've really come to see how just essentially important it is that mindfulness training be brought in everywhere. He's actually started a mindfulness training. It's now core curriculum, actually, for all of the physicians in training at the Albert Medical School at Brown University. He's just instigated that in this past year, if I'm not mistaken. So, very essential, very essential.
Oh, yeah. That's wonderful that training exists and is taking place is at least heartwarming to me to hear that, because it's so important. I did some work for a talk I gave this summer on really looking at what does interfere with doctors engaging with patients at the end of life, and thinking that part of it is the scientific basis of medicine, and death and dying, it doesn't lend itself that well to science and study by science, and science is so much more comfortable with numbers and machines and tests and things that we can actually quantify and that are tangible to us. And so it's the intangible nature.
Yeah, I think it's also, again, that, you know, the medical profession is geared towards cure at all costs. And so death is experienced as a failure versus just, you know, a part of life that is going to arrive. And particularly at a juncture where you have tried, as they did with Mel, so many different things, there has to come a point where as a physician you can and say, you know, I don't have a crystal ball, but it looks to me like your loved one is dying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one of the aspects of this culture of medicine, that when we train as doctors, we develop this belief that our job is to save lives. That's what we're here for, and that's
right.
what our training is all focused toward. Because
right.
our training doesn't teach us that. We can't honestly save lives. Every one of our patients will die ultimately. That
right.
we are here to help people be healthy, no matter
right.
how long their lives are, or to be as healthy as they can be. And if we only changed our mindset that small amount, we could actually make room for the end of life and for death and dying and be comfortable with that and embrace it as part of our role as care providers is to be there with our patients all the way to the very end, no matter what happens.
Yeah, and I think part of what is key in that for just, you know, us as human beings, but also for medical professionals is what does it really mean to listen? You know, what does it really mean for you as an individual, as a healthcare professional, to really listen? You know, when we truly open our hearts and listen, we can be impacted in a variety of different ways. We can be uncomfortable, you know, and what kind of a space within ourselves can we create to be with that discomfort and continue to listen?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and that's exactly where I see mindfulness training being
yes.
being so powerful, because it helps you sit still and quiet your own mind and actually listen and hear and take in what others around you want to communicate.
Yeah, exactly.
And so often in medicine, we're not trained to listen. We're trained to ask questions. We're trained to run down our list of questions
right.
and check boxes
right.
based on answers instead of really hearing what people want to say. And it felt profound to me in your movie that you and Mel did not feel heard. There were not very many people who took the
yeah.
time to really listen, to really listen to what you were going through, what
yeah.
what your experience of this was,
yeah.
which makes me so happy that you made this movie, because this movie is an opportunity now to be heard and an opportunity
yeah.
to put it out there now so that others in the medical profession can understand the need to listen by seeing it on the screen before their eyes. And what reactions have you seen from medical professionals who've watched the movie? What feedback have you gotten?
I mean, you know, so Dr. Levy's using it a lot, needless to say. And I would say that the medical professionals who know that there's a problem, needless to say, feel that it is overwhelmingly important that all medical professionals see it. There's a variety, actually, of endorsements from medical professionals on the website as well. In fact, also, you know, a diplomat of the American Board of Internal Medicine. Folks just feel like it's extremely important for medical professionals to see it. It's being used in medical schools around the country. As well as VAs, I mean, it's being used in contemplative studies programs, gerontology, end-of-life care, palliative care, hospice, nursing, psychology. It seems to be having a pretty powerful impact to realize the profound importance of something so very simple, which is indeed simply being present and listening.
Mm-hmm.
So it sounds so simple, and yet so often it's just really so hard to do.
Well, definitely the movie brings that point home and illustrates
yeah.
that so very well. But I was thinking that this movie could be really helpful to non-medical groups as well. And
yeah.
I know there are these death cafes springing up all over the country where people in a community will just gather together informally and have conversations about the end of life. And I'm thinking that would be a great place to screen this movie, because it does spur so many interesting thoughts and conversation t- topics that I think this could be, that could be a place it could be used. And here in my community, our community college started a course this year on death and dying, which I was so excited to see that for college students, and it filled, you know, with college students in their 20s. But I think this movie would also be a great movie to show to that group of students. They're already interested in the subject of death and dying, and I think this provides so much insight and such a unique perspective that it's hard to present that perspective of the patient and the caregiver to someone who hasn't experienced it.
There does seem to be a lot of young folks who are really interested in this now, and I'm not totally sure why, but I have also a variety of different professors around the country using it, and you know, and I've actually gone to speak at a variety of universities all around here, and it's just a jam-packed room of mostly nursing students, which is interesting because they do seem to be the sort of first line of defense, if you will, for dealing with families, and just increasing, there seems to be just lots and lots of young people who this is really, really important to them. I don't know if that's because there's so many of us older people at this point in time, but, you know, but, and the poignancy that when I spoke actually at Salve Regina a few months ago, I was just shocked at how indeed simple and present so many of the kids, the college kids in this room were, and such insightful questions that they would ask, you know, they really... It seemed as if to me the whole fear and loathing around death might actually be diminishing significantly at this point in time.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right about that. I think there is really almost a sea change that's happening, if you want to call it that, in our society. Mm-hmm. And definitely my kids are both in their 20s, and I see it with them, their friends and the conversations they have and their openness and comfort with it. And I really believe baby boomers, you know, who have been part of the denial process of aging and death and dying for the last few decades, baby boomers are waking up to the reality of getting older and having to face end of life issues. So I do believe it's changing and will continue to change over the next few decades. But I think your movie, Death, a Love Story, is an important part of that process of change. And it's interesting to me that it's been out there now for almost 15 years. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yes,
and,
it is.
In many ways, it may have come out ahead of its time, in a way, but I could see even more so that movie being embraced over the next 10 years providing a message.
I've actually been told that before, and I think it actually might be true. It seems like it's sort of gaining a lot more interest and popularity now than it even did when it first came out, which is really interesting for me to note. And I guess I will also add that, you know, us baby boomers were also the ones that, if you will, took birth out of the closet, right, in kind of
That's
the
true.
60s and 70s, and sort of, you know, made birth something not to be shunned and ignored and left in the closet. And I think in that same way, we are also bringing death out of the closet as something to not be shunned and ignored and feared, but rather embraced as a significant part of life and an incredibly potentially, you know, profound and beautiful part of life as well.
Absolutely. Well, I applaud and thank you for having the courage to make that movie at the time in which you did make it, when there wasn't a lot of support and encouragement for that sort of thing, and for standing behind it and staying with it and keeping it out there and available so that it's still here for all of us to learn from and grow from. And you and Mel have done a beautiful thing.
Well, thank you, Karen, and I thank you for the incredible work that you have done and continue to do. these are really, really important conversations. And, you know, I applaud you and thank you for your profound open-heartedness to provide this arena for these conversations.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is my hope, and that my hope that, as you found with your movie, there will be an ever-growing audience looking for this information and seeking it out. And I have been so thrilled to meet kindred souls such as yourself who are here and willing to have these conversations and to do the work that needs to be done. So, gosh, we've already come to the end of our hour. That went by so quickly, Michelle.
Really quickly, indeed.
I want to thank you one last time for being willing to sit down and talk with me today, and to remind all of our listeners to go to the website for the movie is Death, let's see, make sure I get it right, deathalovestoryvideo.com. Is that correct?
Yep, that's Death correct. Deathalovestoryvideo.com.
And the video can be purchased there for any groups that might want to show it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then you have a second website for your business if anyone's interested in working with you on a documentary film of some sort.
Indeed. And that's Harkin Props. So the company's Harkin Productions. And then the website is www.harkinprods.com, H-A-R-K-E-N, Harkin, to listen, Prods, short for productions.com.
All right. Well, thank you so much. My guest has been Michelle LeBrun. One last time, check out the website deathalovestoryvideo.com and look into ordering the movie to show for your group. And I want to thank all of our listeners for tuning in today. This is your host, Dr. Karen Wyatt, and you can learn more about me at my website, KarenWyattMD.com. You can follow me on Facebook and also on Twitter at SpiritualMD.